Our help is in the name of the Lord, who made heaven and earth. Okay, welcome back to the, I almost said Ancient Christian Writers series, but this is actually the School of Christi, the School of Christ. And throughout these past years now, we've been reflecting upon the writings, for those of you who are here for the first time, the writings of Romano Guardini, a priest who lived in the 20th century. And the work that we're reflecting upon is called Meditations Before Mass, and it was written back in the 1940s. So it was written before the Second Vatican Council. But what we found in his meditations is that they almost seem as though they anticipate what the council would have called us to do if things were implemented, perhaps in the way that the council initially seemed to put forward, which is to educate ourselves in the tradition, to return to the sources of our faith in order that we might grasp more fully what it is to be a Christian, how it is that we worship, how we understand ourselves as human beings, and how we understand our God and our relationship to Him. And Guardini in the work does just a magnificent job, both with giving us substantive material, but also helping us to reflect upon it in such a way that it's understandable and accessible. And we're finishing up the first section, the first half of his book, which has all had to do with pretty much our interior disposition, how it is that we prepare ourselves to enter into the Holy Mass, all the way from stillness, silence, composure, if you remember, to how it is that we enter into the church, how we understand the priests entering up into the sanctuary, how it is that we prepare ourselves to hear the Word of God as it is proclaimed and then preached. And in these last couple of weeks, there's a little three-part series we're doing here now as part of his meditations. It's on the things that he considers hindrances to our full participation in the liturgy. And last time, what did we discuss last time? Somebody help me out. Habit. So approaching the Mass simply out of routine. Tonight he'll be looking at sentimentality, so kind of emotionality in the way that we approach the celebration of the Mass and seeking to make it conform to our own sensibilities, as it were. Not that there's a problem with emotion. We are human beings and that's part of our life, but at times it can take over to the point where we transform the Mass into something that is, or seek to transform the Mass into something that's emotionally pleasing to us, or puts us, not just pleasing to us, but puts us into a kind of emotional state. And Guardini is pretty strong on this, that it's a misunderstanding of liturgy altogether to do that. Again, not that emotion isn't a part of our participation in the Mass, but there is a kind of discipline that we have to have, even over our emotions and the way that we approach the liturgy. And for most of us, it's going to seem, the prayers are going to seem very terse and straightforward. There's a kind of solemnity to it. At times it might be hard for individuals to get through in that sense, that there's not much at times that will seem to be consoling or engaging. And so there is what one might call a kind of liturgical asceticism that we have to have, a specific kind of discipline in the way that we enter into the liturgy, and an internal discipline, what goes on within us in regards to our emotions. And then we'll finish up next time with his final hindrance, which is human nature. That there are certain aspects of how we understand ourselves as human beings that can often hold us back in the way that we enter into the Mass. And then we'll be moving on to the second part of you'll be happy to hear, the second part of the book, which is a series of 11 other reflections on the essence of the Mass itself, the liturgy of the Eucharist, the various aspects of it, and the canon itself. And so we'll be able to really enter into the prayers of the Mass in a very deep way, so that it becomes hopefully very familiar to us. As always, I try to give a little bit of introduction here in the red print, italicized print, and then we'll jump into Guardini's text. And as always, I'll stop after each paragraph if you want to offer any questions or comments or observations. We turn now to the second hindrance to full participation in the Mass, which Guardini identifies as sentimentality. He describes it as follows: the desire to be moved, by loneliness or delight, sorrow or dread, by greatness and exaltedness or weakness and helplessness, somehow to be moved. Surprisingly, it is not what we would consider emotionalism. Most often, Guardini tells us, it is found in those who are rather self-disciplined in approach to things, both in regard to their intellects and wills. It is quite simply a spiritual softness tinged with sensuality. The softness tinges the perception of the saints and spiritual devotion, robbing it, in a sense, of its depth, a kind of Christian piety gone wrong. To the sentimental, the Mass seems overly austere and uncomfortable, and so it and other devotions become tinged with an artificial and unnatural fussiness and saccharine quality. Where there should be silence and depth of reflection, one often finds a stylized mimicry that conceals rather than reveals. The austerity and dignity of genuine mystery is lost to a false kind of mysticism steeped in personal leanings and taste. These personal inclinations must be brought to heel, Guardini tells us, under the powers that govern the inner life of the Church. So there's a lot already packed in that, but I think the thing to draw to attention, our attention here, it's not as though he's speaking of, again, a kind of raw emotionalism where people whip themselves up into emotional fervor and sort of engage in a kind of uncontrolled kind of activity emotionally. And so cast themselves into tears or throw themselves on the ground or become overly ecstatic. According to Guardini, is quick to point out that sometimes it's even found, and most often, in those who seem sort of self-disciplined, at least on the surface. And yet there is a kind of softness, he says there, a lack of interior discipline, and that allows the emotional life to be guided by a kind of sensuality, that there's a desire to make the liturgy into something that really elevates us on an emotional level, to the point of excluding or maybe making us lose sight of the deeper mystery with which it is connected. So you see the importance there. That sometimes if we focus too much on what's going on emotionally and how beautiful the music is or what the servers are wearing or the beauty of the vestments and things like that, or the ugliness of the vestments, that we can lose our focus upon the greater reality and mystery into which we are called. This would be the Paschal mystery, that is the passion, death, and resurrection of Christ. It is this reality that we are called to participate in. And more than that we, by the grace of this holy mystery, by entering into it fully and receiving our Lord, we enter into this unique union and communion with him. Our humanity, as it were, is elevated to a participation in the very life of God. And so we cannot abstract the Mass, the liturgy, from the greater mystery of God's revelation to us, from the incarnation all the way through Christ's crucifixion and resurrection and ascension into heaven. If we do that, then gradually over time, we lose sight of the deeper meaning of the Mass, and we seek to make it, even if it is religious worship, we seek it into something that satisfies our sensibilities. And in that, we subtly over time, and sometimes greatly, can distort the Mass itself and lose sight of the mystery we participate in, but also the kind of life that means we are to live. That our participation in Mass also carries with it an understanding that we are seeking and we are given all that we need to conform ourselves to Christ, to put on the mind of Christ, to allow ourselves to be filled with his love, and so that we make that love manifest within the world. And so there's a kind of asceticism that surrounds our Christian faith, our understanding, our theology, our understanding of what God has revealed of himself, So again, from the incarnation, through Christ's teachings, through his passion, death, and resurrection, all of these things are to be understood, but not outside of the context of the life we lead. That theology, for example, without our living out the Christian life, without conforming ourselves to Christ, becomes distorted. Theology is often seen as an intellectual discipline. You go and get a master's degree or a PhD in theology. But for the most part, the spiritual tradition and the tradition of the church as a whole would see that as foreign. In fact, there are parts of the tradition that would say that that is demonic theology, that treating theology simply as an intellectual discipline outside of seeking to live the gospel and outside of seeking to order our passions through the ascetical life, the life of prayer, fasting, vigils, study of the scriptures, reading of the fathers, that we run a great danger there of simply thinking about the faith, but not ever really being able to enter into the mystery of it in order that we might comprehend it in the way that God desires us to comprehend it. Never allowing God to draw us into the mystery in and through our faith and by his grace. And so our way that we do theology has to be formed by the ascetical life, our living out the gospel, but also the way that we enter into liturgy has to be shaped by our ascetical life as well. We've seen this in all of our initial reflections, that we enter into our celebration of the Mass not in a willy-nilly kind of way and not as we enter into other kinds of worldly celebrations, that we enter into this understanding that we are preparing ourselves for this encounter with God himself. And in particular, we are going to be participating in that Paschal mystery. We unite ourselves with Christ in his passion, death, and resurrection. We are drawn into that mystery, offer ourselves our crosses in union with his, and we are drawn up. The end point of that is to be drawn up into the very life of God. So deification is the end that we seek in all these different areas, theology, liturgy, and the ascetical life. Anytime any one of those threes is abstracted from that end, we've lost our way. And you can see what sort of has happened, or what can happen in both directions. We can become very fussy and overly saccharine and sentimental in even what many people might even think sort of as a traditional kind of way, but we can become focused on frilly vestments or albs and things such as that, or a kind of projecting of a personal piety onto the Mass itself. Or we can slip into a kind of sentimentality that is more banal or worldly. So we lose sight, again, of the grander mystery into which we are called, and it's turned into a kind of narcissistic, self-focused enterprise. So it has all of these religious qualities, but it might not extend beyond that room and that group of people and the emotional experience that they are seeking to get out of it. And so this is perhaps one of the more important things I think that we've discussed. And if you take anything away from this group, I would want you to take away that. Because I don't want this to be kind of a bashing of the past or of the present or what took place in the 60s. Guardini, I think, is calling us to go much deeper than that. I think he's trying to help us see it in the grander perspective of a God who has revealed himself to us, but has also called us to participate in his life in a radical way and has given us the Mass in particular as the summit of that experience, that this is the main way that we enter into that life and are transformed and begin to experience even now, taste something now of the life that we will participate in its fullness in the kingdom. And so avoiding sentimentality means keeping our focus on that reality as we enter into the Mass. And when if we lose sight of that, we're going to move in one direction or another and get off the right track. So that was a lot to throw at you. So does anybody have any questions or thoughts or comments?
You're saying not to be feeling emotionally moved?
No. That's what I want to be clear about, that as human beings, that's part of who we are. We have there's an affective element of who we are. We have our emotions, and certainly that will also touch the way that we worship. But even that which is good in us, and even that which is virtuous in us, must be transformed by the grace of God. So we have to subject even our emotional life to a kind of asceticism, especially when it surrounds the Mass, that we are doing what Christ has told us to do. As you see here, do this in remembrance of me. All the things that we've done here, do this in remembrance of me. A specific instruction has been given to us. It's not take this and make it what you want it to be or make it satisfying in a particular sense, but allow yourself to be drawn into the mystery that I have given you and made possible for you, which is a participation in the mystery of the cross itself. And if we lose sight of that and fall into a pure emotionalism, you know, when we're seeking simply to have good or positive feelings about our experience of Mass, and if we don't, we become disappointed, then we've lost sight of the grander thing that we are participating in. So
you're implying taking what you're supposedly getting out of the Mass and take it into your life. Is that what you're saying, into your daily life?
Or more, not just take it into our daily life. We have to allow it to transform our daily life in a radical way. We are to be conformed to Christ. If the Mass simply becomes our getting together to celebrate some past events that took place 2,000 years ago, even if we have a great love for Christ and a great faith for Christ, but we lose sense of this, that we've been called to this end, which is deification, participation in the life of God, then we've lost sight of why this gift has been given to us.
Well, makes it a little difficult with that, given that we're saying that pretty much the same things we've said for the last half a century.
Well,
and that we're constantly either reading or listening, and now it's very difficult to even get any time personally for yourself in the Mass.
Well, it is difficult, and that's what I'm here to tell you. That there is
good
a kind
time to be the homily.
What?
Good time to get.
Well, there is a kind of dying to self and living for Christ. Where we are seeking to put on the mind of Christ, to see things as he sees them. And that means often letting go of our limited perception of things and allowing ourselves to be drawn by faith into that greater reality. And that does require work. That means fasting, prayer, that means reading the scriptures, preparing ourselves for Mass, having a deep, rich prayer life. And so to answer your question, yes, it's hard work. And if I were to say anything less, I would be lying. And I think it's because we've taken a kind of lax approach to this reality, both in terms of understanding it and then practically how we enter into it. I think that we find ourselves in the position that we are now. There has been a radical breakdown of the fundamental asceticism of the Church. How it is that we seek to conform ourselves to Christ, our understanding of what that reality is, but also the path to that reality. And so we have a couple of generations now, and this didn't begin simply at the Second Vatican Council. I think this was already something that Guardini was seeing as existing in the 1940s, a breakdown of our understanding, not only intellectually, but in and through our faith, and in and through the life that we are living, a breakdown of our understanding of who we are as human beings in the light of what Christ has revealed to us and made possible to us. This is to be the fundamental focus of our entire life. And so it's going to require and should call out from us a greater expression of ourself and giving over of ourself to that reality than any other thing in our life. What is more important than responding to what God has revealed to us in his only begotten Son? And for us as Catholic Christians, the answer to that should be absolutely nothing is more important than that. And so our whole life If the Eucharist is the source and summit of our life, then our whole life should be geared to preparing ourselves to entering into that reality. And as I've mentioned before, we should live from Eucharist to Eucharist. You know, we receive the grace of God, we seek to conform ourselves to God and His will, conform ourselves to the mind of Christ, live that life, and then we are renewed and strengthened in that life again through our reception of the Holy Eucharist and our participation in the Mass once again. And now the Mass is seen as, you know, an end point to our work week, something that we check off. It's of a religious nature, but not necessarily something that is that absorbs our focus as human beings and even shapes the way that we view our relationships, the way that we engage in our daily work and life. So what Guardini is doing is nothing new. I mean, this is what the fathers taught throughout the first centuries of the church. It seems to us as though he's overturning the way that we view reality, and it's essential, absolutely essential, that we allow him to do that. It's not a comfortable position often to be in. We have the same experience when we read Isaac the Syrian on Wednesday night. You know, our understanding of what it is to be a human being who's been drawn into this relationship with God, a relationship of love that also means a participation in the life of God, deification as an end to that. You know, the way that Isaac expresses that doesn't allow you to walk away from reading it, thinking about your life in the same way ever again, except if you're living in absolute denial. Part of the problem, I think, is that we've domesticated the Gospels and we've domesticated our faith. We've heard it so often that we can remain unmoved in hearing something like the Beatitudes, or we can remain unmoved, you know, on the deepest level when we hear the words, take this, all of you, eat it, this is my body. Or take, drink, this is my blood. You know, we might see something of the importance of that, but again, abstracted from the greater reality in which we are to live our lives. Am I speaking quickly tonight? I feel like I'm speaking quickly tonight. It's like too much coffee or something today.
Matthew Kelly does a thing last year with Lent, I think, mm-hmm. when he was talking about instead of receiving the body and blood, and experience the physical dissolve it, experience the reception and the experience of receiving God, and deal into that, right. Get away from it, the taste.
Right. And I think that would be in line with what we're talking about here, but I think the value of doing what we've done with Guardini, that we've been with him now for like a year and a half, and we've been making our way through the Mass, you know, as I said, all the way from our preparation and our participation in the Liturgy of the Word, and now we're going to spend another year just on the Liturgy of the Eucharist, that it allows us to step back and reflect upon how deeply we are participating in that reality, and not what's that called, when you just sort of pull out little things rather cafeteria. Than seeing things in their whole. Well, not cafeteria, but I'm thinking of something a little different, that we're, you know, we're trying to see things in their whole, not just sort of choosing certain elements of the faith out and emphasizing them. Because I think even there we have sort of a truncated, and can have a truncated view. We can have a profound view of the Eucharist and a profound piety even surrounding it, but not grasp, again, the end to which we are called.
And we are participating in the Last Supper, and it's the greatest prayer of the church.
That's right. Right. So why don't we let Guardini take us along here? He speaks a little slower than I do, so hopefully it'll be more understandable. To put it bluntly, sentimentality is essentially the desire to be moved by loneliness or delight, sorrow or dread, by greatness and exaltedness or weakness and helplessness, somehow to be moved. The need is greater with one person than with another, but we all have it to some extent. Strangely enough, it is particularly dominant in people who do not appear at all emotional, self-disciplined men and women of intellect and will, practical, prosaic natures. From this we see that sentimentality is not the same as real sentiment, which is powerful, unclouded, and chaste. Sentimentality is a half-sentiment, a spiritual softness tinged with sensuality. Hence, it is strong not only in people without a clear-cut, genuine sense of values, but also in those who seem to stand completely on character, with emphasis leaning so heavily on will and discipline that the neglected feelings easily slide off into the questionable and inferior. So real sentiment he believes in here, which he says is powerful, unclouded, and chaste. So we do. There is an emotional element with which we approach the Mass. We can stand in awe of the mystery into which we are called. And we can be moved to the depth of our being. But to say that it is unclouded and chaste means that it's ordered and rightly ordered. It's ordered toward God, not simply ordered to an altering of our interior state to give us a kind of feeling, to pull us out of loneliness or to pull us into an experience of loneliness or sorrow. You know, it was interesting how he goes back and forth here, almost with the opposites, because we can use the Mass depending upon our feelings on any given day. If we're feeling glum and sad, you know, we might bring a kind of emotionalism that isn't so much focused upon ourselves, upon God and the mystery into which we are drawn, as it is upon ourselves, either deepening that feeling of loneliness and sadness or of some way of trying to alter our interior experience to lift us out of it. And so we want to respect what is fully human, which is sentiment and emotion. But as all of our passions, as well as our appetites, they are to be ordered toward God. They are to be ordered toward love. All these things we know can be ordered towards the self, and in a selfish way, in a narcissistic way. And so we can be self-seeking and self-interested in all different parts of our life, including the religious life. Religious people aren't beyond having their delusions. And sometimes those are the strongest delusions that we have as human beings, because they surround that which is so powerful, that which has so much meaning. But if we take it and morph it and distort it into something that is more of our creation, boy, can it be destructive, not to only to our own life, but to everyone we come into contact with. All of a sudden, we're trying to compel people to embrace our view of religion, our view of the faith, not necessarily what was proclaimed by Christ or what has been proclaimed by his church for 2,000 years. So important in our day to have clarity and understanding this. Anything about this first paragraph stand out for you here? Okay, let's move on to the second then. All this has its parallel in the religious life. The sentimental believer's attitude to the great figures of sanctity, the truths he prefers, the passages he frequently quotes, his whole bearing, everything disposes him to emotionalism. So in our own personal piety, Guardini is telling us here that we can focus in upon that which speaks to us the most on an emotional level. And then all of a sudden, we see everything through that lens. So we begin to see everything through our own personal piety and interpret everything through our own personal piety, which can have elements of truth in it, but also can have elements that are distorted. And we can also project that on to the Mass itself. So suddenly our personal piety, the things that we even use on a daily basis that to engage in our relationship with God, it doesn't even mean that these things are wrong. But we use the things that have more of a personal attraction to us than to approach and enter into the Mass. And what Guardini warns us about this, he says all of a sudden we're projecting something that is uniquely personal onto what Christ has given to us, given to his church, and what the church teaches us about that reality. And so we begin to question certain elements about it, or how it's done, or what it means, and we want it to conform with that personal piety. And so this isn't diminishing people's personal piety. It's not trying to put everybody in, you know, make everybody a cookie cutter image of each other. It's warning us, though, that because of our uniqueness as human beings, that there are going to be certain things that appeal to us, speak to us in a deeper way, and that we have this tendency to project that, even to project that onto the mass itself in terms of what we think it should be or could be or what we want it to be. Okay? Up to a certain point, there is little that can be said against this. It's simply a predisposition, like a fuzzy mind or weak muscles. But when a believer allows such a tendency to dominate him, it becomes disastrous, robbing revelation of its greatness, distorting the saints, and generally rendering his religious life soft, weak, unnatural, and embarrassing. Examples of sentimentality meet us everywhere. We've only to glance at the popular spiritual exercise leaflets, the average samples of religious art, or to read some of the meditations on Christ's passion or on the poor souls in purgatory. One theme in particular has fallen under this deplorable influence, the Sacred Heart. By rights, this devotion belongs to the profoundest level of Christian piety. Its expressions should be huge with the magnitude of revealed truth and the vibrant with the power of Christ's conviction. It should be noble and pure. Instead, it is only too often characterized as an intolerable effeminacy and unnaturalness. So it's interesting that something can happen then even to our daily piety, that we might have certain saints that we love, or they hold we feel like kindred spirits, or they speak to us in a certain kind of way. But a kind of sentimentality gone wild, as it were, can morph that into something that becomes very saccharine. People often will complain about that in regards to, for example, Thérèse of Lisieux. You know, they turn her into this little China doll, and the little way is turned into exactly that, the little way. It's diminished in terms of, even though she's a doctor of the church, it's diminished in what it communicates to us in regards to our relationship with God. And so often there's a kind of attraction to her because of a gentleness or meekness that we will project out onto her, and forgetting the fact that she was a Carmelite that had a whole, you know, the Carmelites had a whole disciplined life, led this incredibly ascetic life. They were cloistered. She entered at the age of 14 into this life, and she ended up suffering from tuberculosis and dying at age 24. So this was no easy life she led. The little way, you know, was this way of abandonment to God in all things and trusting him as a loving father in the midst of all that. And so for her, you know, the simple movement of the mind and the heart to God was all powerful, you know, that one could enter into all those things and have this kind of radical trust. But we have a tendency to turn that into something much less. You know, sort of as what he describes here, soft, weak, unnatural, embarrassing. It can make our actions affected. And so, you know, this would be acceptable, you know, in some ways for a little child. But even St. Philip Neri, we were told, eschewed this kind of behavior as a little child. He didn't like, he wasn't fond of like building altars for himself and wearing little, you know, vestments and playing the priest, you know. And that sort of followed him into his priesthood. He went into ecstasy. You know, he had the gift of tears, you know, when he was caught up in the depth of that mystery. But he wasn't given over to a kind of affectivity in speech or behavior or in one's spirituality. In fact, he would often rebuke individuals in his own community when he saw that, you know, when it became overly affected in such a way that people would see it, or, you know, where it wasn't something between themselves and God, you know, where, you know, our piety in some way, that intimacy with the Lord should not be something that's out there for everybody to see. You know, not that we hide our faith, but you get what my meaning here, that that deepest intimacy we have with God is between the self and God. Philip's little motto in that regard was Secretum meum mihi, my secret is my own. So the things that took place in his spiritual life, he wasn't broadcasting on, you know, the 16th century's version of Facebook, you know, telling everybody what was going on with himself. He knew that that intimacy, as intimacy involved in, say, the relationship with marriage, was to be guarded and protected because of its preciousness, not put out for the world to see. You know, clearly something that we've lost sight of altogether in our culture, but it can also be something that we lose sight of in our celebration of the Mass. It can become overly affected, both in the actions of the priest and of the congregation. You know, where, and I think this is where oftentimes people struggle with the turning of the priest facing the priest. Turning the priest around facing the congregation, because in some ways it made the focus more on the priest's personality. It would be different if the priest were focused upon the prayers of the Mass and, you know, he was doing what the rubric said and following the prayers, but so often it becomes a display of personality and sometimes over the top in a grand way. You know, I don't want to hold up anybody for mockery, but there's been, you know, priests singing, you know, secular songs from the altar at marriages and things like that, and doing all these kind of bizarre antics, you know, riding a scooter down the center aisle at the end of Mass and the, you know, as they're recessing, you know, at the end, you know, all these strange things going on. And I think even in some sense, the whole idea of the priest walking up and down the aisle preaching is wrong. And the reason I'm saying is because it often overflows into what Guardini is talking about here, because people get wrapped up in the movement, the gestures, and it can become overly affected, even if not to, in a grand way, you know, and it can detract from the preaching of the gospel itself. The priest does not want to become the center of attention. He wants Christ to be the center of attention, both in his preaching, but in the saying of the Mass itself. And so there is a kind of liturgical asceticism there. The priest has to rein that in. He has to be able to celebrate the Mass in such a way with a kind of reverence and clarity that he isn't distracting people from the mystery in which they are participating. And so if he's up there, you know, doing all these things in an affected way, it detracts and leads people astray from the deeper, again, the deeper mystery into which they are being called. You know, he draws attention to here to one of the most beloved devotions of the Church, the Sacred Heart of Jesus. And he's right. You know, the Scriptures speak of this, Old Testament and New. And, you know, Christ's heart being pierced with a lance, you know, on the cross, blood and water flowing out, you know, that this devotion to the Sacred Heart of Jesus, you know, this love that pours its heart, that pours itself out in love for all of humanity, is such a profound devotion for us. It should be rich and deep for us and lead us into the Paschal mystery even more fully. But so often it becomes something that's very saccharine, both in the language, the prayers that are used, the art, statuary, things such as this, that it becomes a distraction from the magnitude of that mystery, which is also a reflection of the Incarnation, that God took our flesh upon himself. divinity embraces humanity in all of its fullness. And so in our humanity, the fullness of the divinity is present, made present to us in the only begotten Son of God. And within that human heart beats an everlasting love. And we often will turn that again into something kind of saccharine that only affects the emotions for the briefest of time, rather than drawing us in to that mystery in the way that it's intended. Yes?
So could even good religious art also become like be distracting and become saccharine?
It can. When it's, you know, when it's approached, when it becomes an idol in and of itself, an end in itself, or when there's a kind of fastidiousness around it, you know, one has to be guarded in that, because that which can elevate can become also a distraction for us, you know, where we become wrapped in it in and of itself, or becomes simply art for us. And I think this is often where the East and the West, the dialogue there becomes very important, because in the East, I think there's this much different view of even religious art itself. The understanding of iconography is that it isn't religious art, that these are windows to the divine. There are a connection with the saints and to Christ himself, and a reminder also that we are to be icons of Christ within the world, that we are to bear within us, and we do bear within us Christ, and the more we conform ourselves to him, the more we make him present to the world, that others are to see in us the divine and the promise of everlasting life. And iconography in and of its nature is a constant instruction and drawing of us into that, if properly understood. And sometimes religious art might fail to do that. It might be exquisite, but it may simply give rise to this emotional element that's, again, abstracted from the deeper meaning of it. And so we have to work, you know, in the way that we view our art in the West, or our music as well. You know, I think, you know, chant is this very austere, you know, way of singing in the Mass. There's a very simplicity, there's a controlled beauty to that, chaste, rightly ordered. You know, it's not meant to whip us up, you know, into a kind, sensualistic, that wouldn't be the right word I'm looking for, but you get the idea. It's not to whip us up in that kind of way, but to direct the desire, the longing toward God, to elevate the mind and the heart toward God. And it's not as though other kinds of music other than chant can't do that, but sometimes, you know, I think if we're honest, if we look at a lot of the music over the last half century, we could say that it's more of a distraction than something that elevates the mind and the heart. I had the idea of posting on Facebook for this group the Church of the Sentimental. And you remember the song of the Partridge Family back in the 60s, Come On, Get Happy? You know, that would be like the poster image of, you know, the overly sentimental kind of music, that we would take something secular like that and turn it in, you know, come on, everybody get happy. This is why we get together, you know, to sing a song, you know, so that we all can be happy. Well, you know, it altogether misses the reality in which we are participating and doesn't direct us to Christ at all. Yes. I'll get to you. Go ahead.
There's something maybe like less, I don't know, less romantic, less uplifting, about approaching our sacred music and sacred art really as the tool that it ought to be. Not that it should be, you know, ugly or banal. I mean, that's completely not the point. It's not tool as in like boring, basic, mundane, but tool as in like right, it's not an end in itself, right? Like, it's almost kind of an odd thing to go to a concert of sacred music, you know? Like, unless it's, like, there's a couple times I've been to a concert of sacred music where it, like, takes place in a church, and the whole sort of point is that eventually you'd end up, like, with your eyes closed and in prayer, and, but then it's kind of weird, like, going to Heinz Hall and listening to, like, a Requiem Mass. It's a little odd. It's like that was, you're literally listening to something that was written for a funeral, and it's supposed to be bringing you into prayer, and it's, the music is a prayer. And there it is, like, just being kind of sung, like, this great piece of classical music, or, you know, sacred art that's in, you know, the Carnegie Museum.
Right.
And you go and you're like, this was in a church. And I think what I'm thinking of is like when Father Yvonne was talking to us about that class he had on creating an icon corner in your home. And at the end of the class, they were praying together at the icon corner. And about half the people were used to icon corners and half weren't. And at a certain point, most of the people just had their eyes closed. And those who didn't were really confused. Like, wasn't the whole point of putting this together that we would pray in front of it? And they were like, the whole point is that it should lift your mind to God, and the moment it does, you can close your eyes and just be with God.
Right.
And you only open your eyes if you need to be drawn back.
Right.
And it's not meant to be, even these beautiful icons aren't meant to be dwelt with, abided with in and of themselves.
Right.
It's interesting.
Right. I mean, I have no problem with the sacred music being, as you said, performed at Carnegie Hall or something like that, or the Benedum or wherever it would be here in Pittsburgh, except for the fact that for most religious individuals, there's a complete disconnect with the fact that, as you said, its original form was, you know, a Requiem Mass, that, you know, there's not that connection that's made anymore. It might be done with perfection, but it might not, and so have a kind of natural beauty to it, but lose sight of the mystical there in the sense of elevating the mind or drawing us into the Paschal mystery itself. And insofar as it only does that, its effect is truncated in a pretty profound way. There's a question in the back here.
I was just saying, it seems like if Guardini is telling me or us, we should be aware of our emotional responses when we're at Mass and be, you know, careful about not being overly sentimental. But then the examples he gives are things that are totally out of our control. I have no say over what the stained glass windows look in the church, or what music they choose, or what pictures of art they have there. I mean, it's there. So someone thinks of making those choices.
Well, it's interesting. I think, you know, things, I think we often come at this from a perspective of those who've experienced bad liturgy for decades on end. And there's a deep frustration that often surrounds that. But even in the face of the negative feelings, you know, a homily that just quite doesn't do it, or music that is poor, you know, or something along those lines, that the liturgical asceticism, if you will, there, you know, would be that our emotions would be chaste, rightly ordered there, that our frustration at that moment would not make us lose sight of the grander mystery in which we participate. There might be a kind of suffering that goes along with that, you know, when we experience the liturgy being done in a banal way, and or where there's disrespect for the greater mystery. But, you know, a mind, a heart, emotions that are ordered, are chaste, are going to be ordered to God even in the face of that. And that's not a kind of passivity where we, you know, would do nothing. You know, I think to be involved in one's parish, to talk to the priest, to be engaged, to be educated in the faith, to understand what it is that we're doing, you know, allows us to engage more directly. You know, but a chaste heart isn't going to, you know, jump up in the middle of the Mass and scream no if they sing a certain song, you know.
Can't we do that?
Huh? Well, you know, I think there are times where people would be tempted to do that. And on some level, you know, it might require heroic virtue at that point. But nonetheless, the heroic virtue is needed.
For a church that has a lot of statues and stuff in it, to say that there is a limit on the art or even the music, I don't totally buy into that. The fact that we're all different and other things there are many ways in which we're talking as though there's just one way to reach God, and
well,
I don't believe that.
Did I say
no,
that?
No, I didn't say that.
Okay.
Okay.
I mean,
but,
or
so
about
there,
the limit.
There are many
did
things.
I, so, did I say the thing about the limit of the
not,
art?
I did not. So I'm saying us as a church have all these things. So I've never thought or felt that I was praying to a statue. Right? I need more than a statue when I'm looking for help. So I'm always seeking God, and I'm bugging everybody he knows or might know for help. What would that ever is happening to me? And sometimes raising it up to a level beyond what I would normally expect in our churches and even getting really excited can meet a different meet some other kind of needs. It takes away, you need to step away from the continuous of it. I mean, the biggest complaint of our Mass is that it's boring by the younger people, which really is translates into it's not all that exciting and I'd rather be sleeping. You know, mostly lazy is when I talk to at least my own kids and stuff that I can talk to about it. And but anything that sort of draws them in, I mean, first you got to get them there. And once you have them there, you can help them develop other kind of things. But if you can't get them there, you're going to have a hard time developing.
Yeah,
but and even though it may be very high in either art or music, sometimes you actually need a break because the Mass does go the other way. There are Masses which are very difficult. And if you didn't have a prayer book or some prayers of your own, it'd be a tough thing to sit through.
But that's that same old song's been sung for the last 60 years. You know, you got to get, not to be flippant, but you got to get them in to the door. Which means is often translated, you've got to do what the world does in order to. But this is often what takes place, that we have to appeal to the senses, and that we have to appeal to the emotions, that we have to compete with the world in such a way that it gives rise to this engaging, interesting experience. It's a kind of lazy Catholicism in the sense of forming the mind, our own minds and hearts. In the minds and the hearts of our children. To understand the difference of what's going on at the Mass from everything else within the world. And that can be very difficult. Eric.
I think we all chuckled when you mentioned the Come On Get Happy and might have thought that it was overly cartoonish or a caricature of things, but I for me it was a little bit more of a chuckle because a church that my mother used to go to, and granted this is Lutheran, not Catholic, for their creed, they literally set the creed to "I'm a Believer" by the Monkees. So, I mean, it really can get that way.
Okay. Yes. Yeah, I know. There are all kinds of aberrations here, but I don't want us, and, you know, I don't want people to feel restrained in expressing their thoughts or frustrations here about these things tonight. But I want to keep our focus on what Guardini is saying. I think it's the more important thing. We've all experienced this kind of sentimentality in one way or another. And I think if we're able to keep our focus on the main things that he's talking about here, which is, you know, even our emotions, our sentiments have to be transformed by the grace of God, especially when it comes to our participation in the Mass, and that our participation in the Mass must be guided by the greater reality in which it makes present to us, which is the Paschal mystery, and also the end of that, which is participation in the life of God. If we can walk away with those two things in mind, I'd be happy. Because I don't want this to be turned into like an anti-emotion, Father David's anti-emotion talk or anti-sentiment talk. That's not what Guardini is saying here. He's saying there is legitimate sentiment, but it should be deep and profound most of all when it comes to the Mass. It must be chaste and ordered. That it's, you know, natural virtue isn't enough for us. or even our virtues, even what is good in us has to be transformed by the grace of God. And that's something that we often forget. Okay, we're moving on. Much more could be said on this subject. At any rate, sentimentality is a force that must be reckoned with. For the sentimental believer, participation in the Mass is extremely difficult. He finds the sacred act neither comforting nor edifying, but austere, coldly impersonal, almost forbidding. And for people like himself, he's right. The Mass is austere. Its tremendous concepts are expressed tersely. Its action is simple. Its words are clear and concise. Its emotion controlled. Its spiritual attitude is that of profoundest surrender, but still and chaste. Sentimentality tries to gild the lily by transferring its own trimmings into the Mass. The altar, never meant to depart from the pure form of the sacred table, becomes a pompous welter of cherubs and little lamps and much glitter. The action is garlanded with gestures contrived, above all, to touch the emotions. The server's apparel is fussy and doll-like. So some of these things, I realize, he's writing back in the 40s, so they might not quite apply today. Text and music are of an ingratiating sweetness. In place of the Missal's powerful language, we find Mass devotions abounding in artificial conceptions and soft, unnatural sentiments. Thus, the central truth of the Mass is lost. The Lord's memorial becomes an edifying exhibition. An earnest participation in the sacred ceremony is supplanted by touching experience. So, even something like Eucharistic adoration, which you all know I love and that we love here at the Oratory and we have perpetually, that even something like a Eucharistic devotion can make us lose sight of if it becomes a kind of end in itself and serving of the self rather than a prolongation of the adoration that takes place at Mass and the opening of oneself in a radical way to the will of God. If it turns away from that and becomes a simple kind of navel-gazing or a way of seeking a kind of emotional comfort for ourselves or emotional elevation, it can slightly be distorted or make us lose sight of the Mass and what's taking place in the Mass uniquely. That what is perpetuated in the adoration is adoration itself. And just like the liturgy of the hours, you know, the office of readings, morning prayer, midday prayer, evening prayer, all those things is a perpetuation of the praise given to God at the Mass. It's the church's liturgy. But if we lose sight of the connection with the Mass and make those forms of piety an end in themselves, and if we also distort them and make them overly emotional or sentimental, then it can detract from our longing for what comes to us through the Mass and through the Mass alone, that we receive He who is our life and our salvation. And if that adoration or those other devotions do not foster within our heart a greater desire to be conformed and transformed into Christ, then they are worthless. And in fact, they can be dangerous to us, he's saying. So, you know, we are used to a kind of individualism, I think. You know, we live, you know, this, you know, it was a Protestant-dominated culture, you know, for a long period of time. And, you know, the sense of the sacramentality of life and the sacramental experience of God, how God makes himself present to us, can be something that is lost in terms of that significance for us, that our experience of God and our understanding of ourselves as human beings radically changes with the incarnation. That everything that we understand about ourselves, about creation, about God himself, is altered at that moment in God's revelation of himself. You know, if we lose sight of that and fall into this kind of individualism, you know, I just like Jesus' style, you know, and we, you know, begin to follow our personal piety, and then that just, you know, creeps into our experience of Mass, then there can become a point where, you know, our experience of Christianity, our understanding of our Catholic faith can really diverge quite in a great, great measure from what it is the Church teaches and what Christ has given to us. You know, we stand at a point now that, you know, a really high percentage of Catholics don't believe in the real presence of Christ in the Holy Eucharist. And, you know, I'm not going to say that that's rooted in this kind of sentimentality, you know, that the Guardini's talking about. But, you know, it can be part of the issue. There are a lot of things that have contributed to that, of course. But, you know, this is something that we need to take seriously in our own spiritual life. You know, I've talked often in some of these groups about, you know, what do they call it? When a person gets up and gives a personal witness, you know, about, you know, is that what it's called? Just testimony. Thank you. And I think in some of the Protestant churches, it was like an altar call kind of thing, too. You know, come up to the altar to give your testimony kind of thing. And, you know, there can be something that is really sentimental about that or plays on the emotions. And I've seen that become really destructive, where a person has gotten up in front of a couple hundred people. And not that I have any problem with sharing, you know, something about one's faith journey, but sometimes they'll get up there and they'll reveal things about their life, you know, their moral struggles, all these kind of things, as well as their how they came into the faith, where it created such a vulnerability that they unwittingly shamed themselves in front of hundreds of people. The self-revelation was too great, and they became so vulnerable that it had such an effect upon them that they gravitated away from the Church altogether. It became what was meant to be an experience of intimacy became a humiliation for them, because they revealed, you know, this deepest part of themselves and their conversion, and even the things that surrounded that publicly before all these people. And so there is a kind of self-revelation that is appropriate, chaste, rightly ordered for being in front of a group of 100 people. So if anybody asks you to do that, it's okay to do that, but just don't get up there and tell your dreams, you know, that you had at night, or tell your most personal experiences before the group. Yes?
You know, when I read this before, this part didn't stick out to me at all. But the thing that I'm finding the most helpful in understanding what he's really getting to is this repeated use of the word chaste.
Right.
And it's like, it's perfect and so helpful, because if you even just, you know, directly apply it to the context in which we're used to using that word, and even within a marriage, you know, if sexuality is engaged in this, you know, lustful way where people are, you know, the husband and wife are just kind of trying to get what they're desiring from the other person, it becomes, I don't know, a distortion of it. But this thinking of like, I'm not going to go to prayer and go to the Mass and seek to get what I need out of the Lord today, like the comfort I need or the support I need, or the, you know, maybe the cathartic feelings of sadness that I need, but I'm going to go to the Lord in a chaste way, the way a husband and wife are encouraged to, which is as a total gift of self to the other and seeking to give to the other. And to just, it's like the most perfect application, because it's like I go to Mass, I go to prayer to adore and to worship and to serve the Lord and to be in His presence, not like desperately going after the thing I really, really want from Him.
Yeah, because in both there's a respect of the mystery of the other. And if the Mass is this act of consummation, Christ giving Himself, body, blood, soul, and divinity to His bride, the Church, then there is a, you know, a kind of way that we have to respect that mystery and enter into it and treat it for what it is. Okay, we need to move on here. So the event which took place at the Last Supper in Jerusalem and the death which the Lord died on the cross both mysteriously interwoven, as his own words reveal, are renewed again and again. Christ commanded, as often as you shall do these things, you shall do them in remembrance of me. The church accepted the command, obeying it through the centuries to the end of time. How does she do them? In the strict form of the liturgy. So not through experimentation, not seeking to making it appealing to the world, but with the kind, again, of asceticism in the context of what Christ has told us to do. That Christ didn't lay out, obviously, in minute detail all the different things that could be done. And I think for a reason, you know, not that there would be all these minute, you know, kinds of prescriptions that would surround what is taking place there to the detriment of our understanding of the mystery of what was taking place there, of what Christ was saying at the Last Supper and what he was saying of himself and how he was giving himself now to the world as Eucharist. And so, but we are to do it and to do it in remembrance of me. We are to do it in remembrance of what he does on the cross and in memory of what he did on at the Last Supper and what he said. And it is to that reality that we are to be faithful, and everything is to be ordered to that. And so when we enter into the Mass, that has to be the thing that's on our mind most of all. And so he can say here in the last phrase, in the strict form of the liturgy. And a couple of times he said here, you know, the tremendous concepts are expressed tersely, directly, concisely. You know, there's not this there's not even this kind of wordiness in our prayers, as you probably have noticed. You know, there's a kind of directness about what they're pointing us to, so that they even do not become a form of distraction for us. Yes, Eric.
So, in the interest of not, you know, being stuck in an angry situation of what we've experienced, but trying to fruitfully, you know, look forward and think with Guardini. I feel as though he is speaking to an audience that was still could remember how things should be done, that there's a certain language there, if you will, that perhaps we're no longer fluent with. Mm-hmm. And it seems like his language kind of fit into the dichotomy of vice versus virtue, the language of the passions. And he's laid out very clear what the vices are. Mm-hmm. And I'm finding myself not as clear as what the virtues are. You know, I'm reminded of Chesterton, who said something like, the reformer is right about what's wrong, but wrong, almost always wrong about what's right. In other words, like, they identify the problem correctly, but the solution is way off. And so I think even amongst people who are particularly interested in liturgy, like, say, for people that are, say, exclusively attending the extraordinary form, there it turns into a sort of nostalgic fetish, you know, that, and so, you know, how do we find the authentic vision when we sort of lost the language?
Right. This, you know, that's why I find that his work has an enduring quality, and there's something prophetic about it, because it spoke to his own time and what he was seeing, but I think it still speaks to our own time, even though our experience of things might be quite different. You explained it perfectly there in terms of how one might approach the liturgy, but sort of in this nostalgic kind of way. That I think what he's putting forward here, and what a more recent author is a Notre Dame professor. He wrote a book called On Liturgical Asceticism, David Fagerberg. Superb work. But he makes this connection between theology, liturgy, and asceticism. And the key there is the ascetical life. That the ordering of the self and the transformation of the self and the conforming of the will and the mind to that of the will and the mind of Christ is what is important. And if there is not that ascetical element in our life, if we lose sight of the exercise of our faith, the ordering of the passions, the growing in the virtues, not just in a moralistic sense, but in this deeply relational sense of being united to Christ, that if we lose sight of that, then other things crumble. Theology becomes an academic discipline disconnected from experiential knowledge of God. Liturgy becomes something worldly or banal, disconnected from the paschal mystery and done in this overly sentimental way. It's the ascetical life. All these are like three molecules, if you will. And if, you know, one sort of falls out of there, we're in trouble. They're all connected. I don't know, that might be a poor analogy. I'm no scientist, so help me out there a little bit. But you get the idea. If some essential element falls out of that, then it becomes distorted. Something grotesque can develop in one direction or another. It can be into a nostalgia or a complete kind of worldliness, an affected nostalgia or a complete worldliness. So just, that's where we said before, if we were just to, you know, turn the priest around and return to the extraordinary form, if we were to do that tomorrow, it's not going to change everything within the life of the church, because you're leaving out two other fundamental elements: true theology, which arises out of experiential knowledge, which is also connected to the ascetical life, which is an ordered love directed toward God. You know, all of oneself is given over to Him. One becomes Christ-like. And that's what I think Guardini ties together, and what David Fagerberg ties together in an even more clear and concise way, because he unites East and West in his thinking. He's a Western Christian, but well-schooled in the ascetical writings and the mystical writings of the East. And so he can bring them together in order to articulate, I think, what Guardini saw so well and writes so well about here, but with a kind of clarity, a precision that we need for our own day. Yes?
I just wanted to respond. I thought Eric's comments were really good, but it reminds me of a movie recently called Midnight in Paris, where they kept romanticizing the last period, and mm-hmm. everyone kept somehow magic going back, mm-hmm. and then they would meet someone who wanted to go back further.
Right.
You know, kind of saying, no, mm-hmm. be present to where you are.
Right.
He's right. It's perfect. I actually was thinking that earlier, because it's the exact same thing. He idolizes the 20s and he goes back to the 20s, and the young woman he meets idolizes the turn of the century and he doesn't understand.
Yeah.
And everyone just wants to be because they think everything would be perfect.
50 years ago,
right.
Was the gold era.
Mm-hmm. Right. 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 But we can still be neglecting the most essential elements. Right. Okay. How would such doing look had it been left to the religious sentiments, if not downright sentimentalities of the pious? To have an idea, we really should examine some of the devotional leaflets. Everything would be extremely wordy and moving. The fearful and gruesome aspects of the suffering would be stressed wherever possible. Jesus' love would be constantly a reiterated theme. A pious importunity would accost him, praise and pity him, place all sorts of touching phrases in his mouth. The text of the Missal would speak quite differently. They are clear and concise. I'm sorry, they do speak quite differently. They are clear and concise. Their tone is that of profound emotion, dignified and controlled. Jesus himself is hardly addressed, not at all during the canon. Briefly, at the completion of the act of commemoration in the Agnus Dei and in the prayers before communion, always with great reserve. As a rule, the words of the Mass are addressed to the Father. There's no mention at all of the Lord's feelings during his passion and dying. Veiled in deepest reverence, they stand mute before the whole mystery. And so there was a sense in which the extraordinary form of the Mass did protect that, the sense of the mystery in which one is participating. And I think the Eastern Rite liturgies do that, and the Eastern Orthodox liturgies do that, you know, protecting something of the mystery, that while their prayers might be more lengthy and the singing might be greater within the Eastern liturgies, and silence is more part of the Western liturgy, by nature in this conciseness. Still, you know, they seek to protect that mystery in order that people might be drawn into it. And but if left to our own devices, we would probably turn it into something far more sentimental. We would be putting words in the Christ's mouth. Whereas we find, as Gordini tells us, the words are very concise, the prayers are concise, plus the direction is always to the Father, the offering, Christ's offering of himself to the Father, and we are to be participating in that reality through our own self-offering, our own union and communion with Christ by the grace of our baptism and through our reception of Holy Communion. We participate in that mystery, in that offering of the self at the altar in this radical, radical way. And so if we lose sight, he says, of that this is directed to the Father, that we're participating in the Son's offering of himself, we again lose sight in a disastrous way of the mystery that we are participating in. And so if we circle things around, and I think this is the complaint of more modern times, you know, if the priest is turned around and even the churches are built in the round, it can create this kind of narcissistic, self-absorbed kind of thing, rather than the priest leading this prayer to the Father, standing in the place of Christ, acting in persona Christi, you know, especially in that liturgical moment, an icon of Christ. He's to be in every way. You know, often he's turned around and the Mass can become a spectacle rather than a participation in that radical self-offering to God. Where did I leave off here? As for the sacred action, we see from the Passion plays how the sentiments of the believers would have developed it in the direction of an elaborate mimicry of what took place in the room of the Last Supper and on Golgotha. When we consider the alternatives, we begin to realize what divine powers were necessary to create something as truly God-inspired as the Mass is. And so we can become too literalistic. Like we try to turn it into a play and enact things as if it were a performance. And if that, you know, it's not that that wouldn't have a place in, again, in personal piety, but if that sort of infects our view of the Mass, again, it can distract us from the mystery into which we are being drawn, which is far greater than anything our imagination or our piety can produce. We are being drawn into something that is beyond intellect, that is beyond imagination, that is beyond emotion, you know, our limited human emotion. We're drawn into the very life of God. And so if we approach the Mass in this reductive way, you know, as something emotional or overly sentimental, again, we are hobbling ourselves from being drawn into something far greater than we could ever comprehend. And so we do ourselves a disservice, unwittingly, perhaps, but nonetheless, we do ourselves a disservice. Here is neither mimicry nor sentimental vicarious experience. What took place on Golgotha does not come to the fore at all, but remains eloquently silent behind the whole. The action is taken from the event in the supper chamber, again, not imitated, but translated into a strict, stylized form that conceals as much as it reveals. The early Christians believed that it was proper to clothe the sacred mystery, the sacred in mystery, I'm sorry. One reason for their attitude was the danger of persecution, which profaned it at every opportunity, but they also knew that mystery is the natural element of holiness. This element has been lost to us or allowed to sink into the twilight of emotionalism and false mysticism. Possibly one of the most pressing tasks of the religious renewal is to rediscover genuine mystery and the attitude it requires, an attitude that has nothing sentimental about it and that flatly refuses to facilitate the demands of faith, preferring to guard its full austerity and dignity. The liturgy alone may be the only genuine arcane discipline still in existence, be found and acquired. So it's arcane for a reason. You know, it's because we are not on our own motivations to add to it as we see fit. We understand that we are participating in a mystery that God has revealed and made present to us and allows us to participate in it. And the way that we pray is to reflect our understanding of that belief. And so we cloak the sacred in this mystery because we realize that we're being drawn into something that is, again, far greater than we can comprehend. You know, to make it all accessible or to dumb it down or to become overly expressive or to make the music, you know, again, simply be there to stir the emotions is, again, to hobble ourselves and prevent ourselves from being drawn into something far greater. And so he's saying the recapturing of our understanding of mystery is essential. And I think that's true across the board in terms of how we understand ourselves as human beings. You know, the more that we've lost sight of the mystery of what it is to be made in the image and likeness of God, but also but redeemed through the blood of Christ and have received his spirit, and so called to this deification, called to participate in the life of God, the more that we've stripped ourselves from that, the more then our understanding of being a human being has been diminished, and not only of ourselves, the loss of our sense of a dignity, but the loss of the sense of the dignity of the other. And, you know, this is something that's not easily recaptured. We've moved to a new kind of barbarism that so belittles the value of the other that they're willing to shoot them over something that they get angry about. Yeah. And so, you know, it's, you know, religion is often treated in our day as if it is something that diminishes humanity or makes us lose our freedom and our identity, that somehow it controls people's lives. But the reality is now it's people's lives are controlled by the ever-shifting popular culture. And with that has become a diminishment of our understanding of the nature of what it is to be a human being. It's become more and more base, not elevated. The strict form of the Mass then, or wait, is that where I ended?
Yeah.
The strict form of the Mass then aims at the exact opposite of what sentimentality desires. Sentimentality, desirous of being moved, employs to this end stirring gestures evocative of terror and helplessness, words dripping with feeling, exciting imagery, moving dialogue, and the like. Nothing of all this is to be found in the Mass. Thus, the sentimental believer has three choices. He can relinquish all hope of establishing vital contact with the Mass and retire into his own sphere of private devotions. He can falsify its character, turning it into a kind of moving passion play, or he can courageously face his inclinations and bring them to heel. Sentimentality must be overcome, otherwise genuine contact with the Mass is impossible. The individual must discard once and forever the habit of judging it from his personal leanings and taste, for its form is that which obedience to the Lord's command has received from his church. Of course, here too, exaggeration must be avoided. Neither her ceremonies nor her wording should assume the absoluteness of dogmas. But this much is certain. The manner in which the Lord's memorial is executed in the church is the lex orandi, the law of prayer, the norm of divine service. He who really wishes to believe, in other words, to obey revelation must obey also in this, schooling his private sentiments on that norm. Then it will be clear to him that here a spiritual life of quite different dimensions from that of his personal piety is at work. He will come to know feeling that emerges from the profundity of God. He will enter into the inner realm of Christ. He will experience in himself the powers that govern the inner life of the church. extraordinary last paragraph, isn't it? That he schooling his private sentiments on that norm. So the asceticism is to school our sentiments on what it is that we participate, who we understand ourselves to be, and what God has revealed. Do this in memory of me. It's then that a whole different kind of spiritual life begins to emerge for us that is rooted in our obedience to Christ and rooted in the life that he's revealed to us. And that does not strip us of feeling. I thought the last couple of sentences were great. A feeling that emerges from the profundity of God. He will enter into the realm of Christ. So we begin to experience something of the life, the love that exists within the Holy Trinity itself. We often will settle, you know, for, as it were, the paltry alms that the world will throw in our laps when they tell us this is what liturgy is and this is what your personal piety should be. And because it satisfies the emotion for a moment, we're willing to seize hold of it. Whereas what we're offered from Christ through the church is an experience of the love of the Most Holy Trinity itself. And if that is not to be prized, if that is not prized or to be sought above all things, I don't know what is. You know, if this isn't worth our effort of ordering our whole self toward God, theologically, liturgically, ascetically. I think this is what Guardini communicates so well.
It's very impactful. I felt, for me, the logical conclusion then is that what has become popular these days, it seems, to kind of parish hop to find, you know, porridge that's just right for you, is what we're learning here, that as long as the parish you live in has a licit mass, you should be going there and entering the mystery and kind of carving or peeling away the stuff that's disrupted.
Well, I've been clear about this with people before, that I felt, you know, that there are certain rights that individuals have as Christians within the life of the church, and that is to be nourished upon the fullness of the faith. And so if you happen to be at a place where things are done so bad, there's even a question at times of validity, for example, or if something contrary to the faith is being taught, you know, I think where that leads a person, or could lead a person, in a sense, to despair or loss of faith, I think that's problematic for me to say, because of what we've read here, you have to go to that parish. But that's different from saying, you know, there are times where you'll go to your parish church or need to go to your parish church and the homily might not be great or the music might still, you know, be of a quality of what it has been the last number of years. But there has to be a kind of formation of mind, of heart, of emotions that allows you to enter into that mystery as it is in it of itself, not in the ways surrounding it that have been distorted. And that's where the hard work comes from, that he says it is difficult, you know, because this means that we are really striving on a day-to-day basis to allow our minds and our hearts to be formed by Christ, and in such a profound way that our eyes are only for Christ. We have eyes only for Christ. And so the moment we walk into that church and see the tabernacle and see the altar and the way that we prepared ourselves beforehand and going over the readings and even looking at the antiphons for the day or the prayers of the Mass, we have prepared ourselves to enter into that no matter what. And that's, you know, it's much easier for us to moan and complain because there's a kind of morbid satisfaction we find in that. Now, I worry in our day because things have gotten so, you know, confusing for people and so upsetting. And there's this feeling that, like, disaster's around the corner because of things going on within the life of the church, that it's thrown, I think, a lot of people in panic mode and a desire to try to control that reality. We have to act. Something has to be done. And there's this constant conversation about it. And then so all of a sudden there is an existence in a constant state of agitation to the point that they lose that inner stillness that is born of prayer and the ascetical life that allows them to worship God. So, you know, at every Mass, they're seeing the things that are, you know, out of order or what, to the point of rage, you know. Or, you know, I think a person can fall into despair, despondency, and end up losing their faith if that's all they're immersed in and there isn't that ascetical element that keeps them focused upon Christ in every other aspect of their life. So if we're only seeing this from aesthetics, the Mass from an aesthetical point of view, and if we're only seeing things theologically in an intellectual way, or in liturgy in an intellectual way, then we are going to be driven to such distraction and anger that we lose the capacity to worship. And that's where we have to guard our hearts. Eric.
It seems to me that it would be possible to even take the sense of mystery to an extreme, that it becomes a sort of Gnosticism, that there's this, you know, special knowledge that only certain people have the privilege of knowing. And, you know, how do we avoid that error? You know, because it seems like anywhere you turn, there's some way to, you know, pervert something to the extreme or what right. It shouldn't be.
I think by taking responsibility for our lives, not being heedless or negligent, not expecting, because we can't anymore, that we're going to be educated in the faith. We don't have the nuns teaching in this Catholic school as we did. And, you know, that there, you know, the faith often isn't taught in its fullness. And so we all have the capacity and the responsibility to educate ourselves in the faith and form ourselves in the faith to the greatest extent. And that means we do everything in our power to you know, grow in grace and virtue. We participate in the sacramental life, confession, Mass. We read the fathers, we read the church teachings, you know, we read about the Mass. We seek to educate ourselves in every possible way. We have a spiritual director, you know, all those things to help form and shape the mind and our heart. Yeah, the devil's relentless and unresting. And so that sort of tells us what our vigilance has to be like in this regard. Because we could easily slip and go in either direction. We should probably stop there. I know that we can talk afterwards if anybody has any further questions, but there is coffee and dessert at the back table, and for anyone who wants to stay and socialize for a little while, as well as little postcards of the upcoming events. First Friday vigils, the next Schola Christi, the next oratory lecture, as well as the holy hour for priests. And so they're all on the back table if you want to take those with you. So, what's that? And Vespers, right, every Sunday evening. So let us close here tonight with the prayer to St. Philip Neri on the back page. And then we'll do the first three verses of the final hymn. Let us pray. Look down from heaven, Holy Father, from the loftiness of that mountain to the lowliness of this valley, from that harbor of quietness and tranquility to this calamitous sea. And now that the darkness of this world hinders no more those kindly eyes of thine from looking clearly into all things, look down and visit, O most diligent keeper, this vineyard which thy right hand planted with much labor, anxiety, and peril. To thee, then, we fly. From thee we seek for aid. To thee we give our whole selves unreservedly. We thee we adopt as our patron and defender. Undertake the cause of our salvation. Protect thy clients. To thee we appeal as our leader, an army fighting against the assaults of the devil. To thee, kindest of pilots, we give up the rudder of our lives. Steer this little ship of thine, and place as thou art on high, keep us off all the rocks of evil desires, that with thee for our pilot and guide, we may safely come to the port of eternal bliss.
Amen.
Amen. The Lord be with you.
And with
you. May God bless you, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit.
Amen.
St. Philip, pray for us.